I've always wanted to know a guru. Well, I have two gurus. I have two gurus here. The gurus of how to, Al and Larry. Oh,
we do some magic, you know.
Isn't the plural of guru, gurai?
I don't know, gura. But also, the Ubels are known as accurate building inspectors of Brooklyn, New York.
Yes.
But on our show, you are definitely the gurus, and we take our listener calls at 212-433-9692, people who have questions about home repair and related
matters.
And
we take them seriously.
Of course.
Well, absolutely.
You give wonderful answers to complicated problems.
Well, now that Philip...
And then I wonder how many people actually go out and do what you tell them to do.
Well, now that Philip fixed all the family problems, we'll fix the house problems.
And when you are here, on top of answering all of the questions from our listeners, you have a question of your own.
Oh, yes. We have the word of the bi-monthly
visit to the show.
And this is it's an interesting thing that I came across. And what it is we want the audience to figure out what the name of the brick and stone laying method, which dates back to the first century BCE. This is where the bricks are large bricks or stones laid in courses with thinner bricks and then repeated all the way up to the top. This is a method of brickwork, and you see it around the city of New York, not often, but it's a Roman and Greek kind of brick and stone laying condition.
Although it's something that I've seen elsewhere. I've seen it in the Southwest, where the Anasazi use a similar masonry approach.
Also, I guess the Adobes use the same things also.
Is it? Do you think it's because it works well? Why this approach rather than just evenly shaped brick?
Because what the thinner bricks, from what I see, do is they lock the bigger bricks together. So you don't have to use large bricks to lock them all together and get a monolithic wall. And so you have these smaller, we call them now, if you look at masonry walls, the header course, which is sometimes called a row lock. So it locks the two rows of bricks together.
I can't afford to wear a row lock.
Yeah, well, there are bricks that do the same thing. There are bricks that are common bond, a gnomon bond. There is all kinds of things. But this is specific to having large bricks or stones, and then on top of that, a thin layer of stone, and then again repeated with a large layer. This particular method has a specific name to it, and that's what we want the audience to figure out.
And it's a word I've never seen before. Right. I'm not going to say any more than that.
Ditto. No. Ditto.
But I have to say, thank the Lord that the online dictionary can speak.
Well, we have invited listener calls, and also, of course, we invite listeners to write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Is there anything you want to talk about before we get going to the calls and the things that people have written in?
There are two things. One is as you well know, there's a lot of gentrification going on in Williamsburg and in what they call – used to call Bushwick, which is now being called East Williamsburg. And what people are doing is they're buying these homes, dilapidated to some extent, renovating them and flipping them. And I have to say that many of the flipped homes that I'm looking at these days, the construction quality has been substandard, subpar. A lot of things that should be done are not being done. And you really do have to know the credentials of the person who's flipping the home or the organization that's flipping the home, because me and my partner Matthew are really of the belief that we're going to hear about people dying, because I've done inspections, so has he, where they vented the heating system right back into the living space. So combustion gases from the gas furnace or the oil furnace are actually filling up the heated space of the building. And
well, people, don't you have to get inspections?
I have to say, we have a new paragraph in our reports, because after we go and do the inspection, we then go online to the Department of Buildings, which this is for everybody. Anyone can look. You don't have to just be a guru of how to. You can go online and do the research, and you see that the whole building's been renovated, walls have been moving around, and there hasn't been a permit pulled on that building ever. So this is telling me that everything that's done, you don't see that thing on the door, that, you know, that permit that people see on doors. And also, if you do see a permit on the door, actually read the permit. It may not even be for the address of the building you're buying.
So that's a permit voluntary?
No.
No.
Well, if you don't get a permit, you don't need to get a permit for to do all the work.
Are you
working illegally?
There is unscrupulous people out there. Let's understand that. And they're they're out to take your money, whether it's
who would have thought.
And what happens is, and people are hungry to get a house or a home or a place to sleep in. They don't want to sleep in the street, and they want to get out of their in-laws' house
Just want to live in the part of the New York where everyone's living.
So what this flipping, that the term flipping, is some guy buys a house for next to nothing, and he puts in less than the minimum into the building. You know, if they would put the minimum, it would be okay, but they put less than the minimum.
Just make it look livable enough to sell it.
And also, you were asking about if they do work on buildings and there's no permit, how's that allowed? Well, if no one sees it and they're very clandestine about the way they do their work, they don't leave anything on the outside, the workers are kind of very stealthy about the way they do things, unless a neighbor complains, the buildings department they have so much work dealing with the complaints, and they do a great job dealing with the complaints they have. If no one's complaining, they're not trolling the streets looking for it, unless he happens to be down the block looking at something else, and then he sees something going on that's amiss, and then he might report that one. That happens also.
You can't blame it on the building department. Last year, we reached 1 million buildings in the city of New York. That's a lot of buildings. You can't expect them to get to everybody. But the only way they know, that somebody has to throw up a flag, has to call them on the phone, call 911, call 311, call somebody, and it'll get documented. And
so
you're sure somebody's going to go down and take a look to see if it's kosher.
So if you're buying one of these homes, you definitely should have some advice in the buying process of someone who knows about the mechanics of the building as opposed to just the legal aspect.
The gurus of how to are here, Al and Larry Ubell, Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York. And all of our lines are filled, but keep calling. It is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. I am Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC, WNYC.org. Let's take a call, okay? This is Joy.
Hi.
From Maplewood. Hi, Joy.
Hi, Joy.
Good. I have a house that has asbestos shingles on it, and one side is chalking badly, and it's time to get it painted again. And we're getting estimates, but some of the estimates say one coat of tinted primer, one full coat, and then some of them are saying two coats. Is there, you know, like for a total of three coats? Is there any rhyme or reason? What do I need to look for? The last paint job didn't really last on one side of the house.
Well, what you can do as far as coatings are concerned.
Can I just ask one question first? Because I want you to answer the question.
And I'll take over.
Yeah. What exposure is the side that's deteriorating?
North east.
It's east. Okay. And probably not a lot of shade on that side of the house?
No.
Yeah, okay. Continue.
Well, the thing is that On some of the containers, they tell you what the material or the coating is going to be applied for, whether it's interior, exterior. And in fact, if you go online to that particular manufacturer and you punch up asbestos coating materials, they will tell you which ones of their products are appropriate for coating asbestos shingles. There are a lot of companies that make all kinds of different materials, but once they advertise that their material is a good coating material for that particular asbestos, then you're doing the right thing. And they'll even tell you how many coats are appropriate and for what part of the country you're going to be putting in, because those cans go all over the country, the southern hemisphere, the northern hemisphere, and this way they'll say give you different specifications for different parts of the country.
The only thing I want to say
is, New York requires something different than
there is
Atlanta,
no really
Georgia?
Requirement.
Yes.
Yes,
and that actually holds true to windows, but we'll get to that in a second. The only thing I want to say is if the east exposure is the one that's deteriorating the quickest, then my advice would be to do the extreme coating on there, the three coats, but on the other three sides, which are standing up pretty well, save you money and do two coats on those sides.
That's a good idea.
I mean, if they're not deteriorating and they look good after a reasonable period of time,
like seven years.
Save your money.
One last thing about painting. The paint most paint or coating materials are only as good as the surface that they are being applied to. If those surfaces are not clean and they have schmutz on them, dirt on it, or something like that, or some sort of residue or moss growing on, that particular coating is going to fail. I guarantee that. The idea is that any surface, including asbestos, has to be washed down before you put a coating on.
Aren't you afraid of getting some of that asbestos out into the air?
No, if you wash it down, it goes into the void. The water prevents the atmospheric deterioration. We're not trying to deteriorate the asbestos.
They're just going to hand scrape the loose parts off.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could do that, but you still have to wash it down with some sort of...
Yeah, they're going to wash it with TSP.
With detergent or something like that. Mm-hmm. It says so on every single can. Surface must be clean.
Yeah, it says clean and smooth. I remember, what's his name, Andy Rooney just used to say, well, if it's clean and smooth, why do I have to paint it?
Troy, thank you so much for calling us. A listener wrote in, my question concerns Swiffer wet pads, which the woman who helps me with cleaning, I'm 80 years old, was using. We realized they should not have been used on our hardwood floors. They removed the varnish. So now we have sections of my floors which show white ores. Is there anything you can suggest to cover these white boards? I cannot revarnish the floors.
It seems to me that the Swiffer pad, whatever material she put on that pad, had some kind of solvent in it.
Because Swiffer shouldn't have that.
It shouldn't have that effect at all. I don't know what she might have added to it that caused the surface to deteriorate. You might be able to, if you could determine what the surface was originally coated with, and just repair those areas where the surface has become deteriorated.
Yeah, she could have used some scouring powder together with those pads.
Yeah,
that is an abrasive that could take off some of the
or
material.
Just cause it to scratch up and become foggy.
That's right.
Now we have an asbestos consultant who's called in. Ben, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Ben.
Hello, Leonard.
Hi.
Is there anything you want to add about asbestos?
No, I just called in case there were questions since we were discussing an asbestos material.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that scouring with something abrasive is perhaps not the best idea.
Yeah, that's... I agree with you because that's what she was getting at, scraping and painting, and scraping it off, and I think that's not a great idea. You just really just want to wash it down.
Unless you're wet scraping. Again, mostly asbestos is in inhaled contaminant, and if you're wet scraping. But if you're doing a certain amount of repair within New York City or New York State, you've got to be careful. If you're disturbing greater than certain quantities, you may have regulations to deal with.
Thank you so much. I know we're doing as best as we can here.
And I know that this woman is in New Jersey, and New Jersey has probably even more stringent regulations on such things.
Yes.
John in New Jersey wrote, my wife and I are renovating our kitchen. We painted the ceiling and the beadboard wainscoting.
Well, wainscoting, depending on where you come from.
And we bought new appliances. We're going to put a stone countertop in, and we're thinking of using plastic beadboard as a backsplash to continue the look. Mm-hmm. Do I need to use something heat-resistant behind the stove, or can I continue the beadboard? It's a slid-in style stove, and we plan to mount a microwave stove exhaust above it. I installed the wainscoting in the kitchen and in the guest bedroom.
I have to say that I'm a little bit apprehensive of putting in any kind of flammable material behind my stove, because if you put a big pot on the stove, the heat goes around the stove and then is diverted very close to that beadboard. So, I mean, I would actually try to not continue it there, do something different, like what I did in back of my stove is I did a decorative medallion of ceramic tile with a Wonder Board, which is, sorry for the brand name, it's a concrete wall board, which is also inert to pretty inert to heat, and that's what I did for my backup. So for that area there, I would actually consider either doing that, stainless steel, maybe even continuing the stone motif that you're doing for your countertop behind there or something like that. By the way, I want to say one other thing about microwaves that also double as vents. Make sure you put a good distance between your cooktop and your microwave, because microwaves have a lot of electronics in them, and if you expose them to a ton of heat, they really are going to fry, and then you're going to have a useless microwave above your cooktop. I was going to do that, and I was talked out by many people who are knowledgeable and appliance people, and I went with a straight-up hood. But people need the space, so give it the room and make sure, read the reviews, that it will last. Also, one other thing, microwaves don't have a great air movement, CFMs, cubic feet per minute. So you really, you know, they don't move that much air.
Now, we're going to go to a little break, but I thought that since a few people have called in with possible answers to the quiz, that we would talk to them, the quiz being brick or stone masonry consisting of thin or no bonding of courses?
What?
Alternating heavy, taller courses with thin, narrow courses. What is the word for this? It was used in Greek and Roman construction around the first century BCE. Let's find out what Mary thinks it is. Hi, Mary.
Yes. Hi. Hi, Mary.
Yes.
What's up?
Hi.
Do you have an answer?
Yeah, what's the answer to the quiz?
It's Eschler, A-S-H-L-A-R.
No, that's not what we're looking for.
That's not what we're looking for.
Do you know what Eschler is?
No.
but I know that's not it.
okay, maybe Kevin knows the answer. Kevin,
what's the answer?
You know, I forgot about the Greek and Roman reference that you made. I was going to say English bond.
No, not English bond.
But I love writing on English bonds.
Me too.
Let's take a little break, and we'll be back with the Gurus of How To and your calls, 212-433-9692. Or you can write to us on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopez. Stay.
You've been gone such a long, long time. How you gonna fix this broken heart of mine? You've been gone such a long, long time. How you gonna fix this broken heart of mine? Mr. Fixer.
And we are back with the Gurus of How To, Al and Larry Ubell, and we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopez. Evelina, is
Hello?
It? Evelina from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
What's up?
Hi. Yes, I bought one of those houses in Bushwick that they did the flip on. And I recently just called a gentleman to come in and take a look at my gas furnace just to make sure it was clean and doing its thing. He told me that I need to make a repair to my chimney for $2,800. Prior to my purchase, I had an inspection done by an engineer who charged me $600. That was a year and a half ago, who said that everything was fine. So who do I believe?
Well, the thing is, I have to say that with the did he climb on the roof and look down the chimney?
Yeah, he did, and he said that there was a lot of terracotta coming off of the brick,
mm-hmm.
and he had them very clearly inspect the roof. We were very concerned about the roof and the chimney and all that stuff.
And
they said that everything was fine.
Well, I'm going to just say that, you know, that he did say that I'm not here to defend him. I don't know him. I don't know the inspection.
Yeah, sure,
but it's saying that there was indication of, you know, when we do an inspection, we see the deterioration of the terracotta tile. That's actually an indication that things are going downhill and they're certainly not going to get better. The fee of $2,800 to reline the chimney is not terrible, but I also would recommend that instead of doing that at this time, you might want to spend a couple of dollars to have someone videotape the interior of the chimney and see if that condition goes all the way down to the basement. If that condition is only at the top, because remember, the moisture from the combusted fumes condensates at the top, which has a lot of chemicals in it, and hydrochloric acid being one of them, causes that tile to deteriorate much quicker at the top than it would at the bottom. So I'd recommend doing spending a little bit more money on doing some investigation before you spend the whole $2,800. You may end up having to spend the whole $2,800 anyway.
But she might very well only spend less having that top part
fixed. She might only have to have the top part repaired. Or, you know, and also I don't know what's going on at the bottom, and neither does he, because he, you know, we're not allowed to pull out the vent connector to see what's going on down there. So I would do a little bit more before you go coughing up. And now that the heating system is kind of over and you haven't died, then you actually have a lot of... You actually,
that's a good thing, right?
Very positive.
Well, we wouldn't have taken your call if you had.
Yeah, very, very positive about the non-death issue. But anyway, but now you actually have some time the whole summer long to make sure that things are in good shape and what the case is.
Okay, Evelina?
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Good luck.
George from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, go on.
I wouldn't have missed it for the world.
I live in the village, and I have a working fireplace, which is really amazing.
Yes.
However, during Sandy, a lot of the moisture came down the chimney, mm-hmm. and now my entire apartment is filled with mold. And I brought it to the attention of the landlord, and he said, not my problem. In fact, when he gave me a renewal lease, it has a thing that I have to sign that basically says I've got to assume responsibility for any mold in the apartment. Now, what can I personally do about it, since he doesn't seem to want to? And his first solution was just have the apartment painted, and that should do it.
Or as far as the clause is concerned, that sounds like a possibility. I'm not a lawyer, but we work with a lot of lawyers. That may possibly be an illegal clause. You're not he as a landlord. Is this a multiple dwelling? Does it have more than one? How many families?
It's a landmark tenement building.
Yeah, but how many families live in that building?
You know, a typical village thing that
let me ask you a question. How many families live there?
There's 10.
Okay.
Well, that goes under the multiple dwelling law, and I don't think that clause that he put in there is going to stand up at trial or a courtroom, because that's avoiding that's a clause that avoids his responsibility. That building is his, not yours,
right.
And therefore he's responsible for all of the safety elements to that building.
But let me ask about mold. There's a difference if the mold is just interior or if it's coming in from outside.
Well,
if it's just interior, it's easy to take care of, isn't it?
Well, actually, you can't really take care of mold. Is all over the world. It's on the South Pole, the North Pole. The three elements that take place in a building that grow and propagate mold. It's, first of all, the right temperature. It's like a petri dish, a nutrient and moisture. People who don't take shower without opening up a window raise the relative humidity in that building to 100%, sometimes like 85%, 75%. Also, if you have a leak, that gives a moisture.
But I have to say that one of the issues I have about this particular person's issue is that this is Sandy, which is already, a year and a half gone by, and this moisture condition still exists. So it tells me that whatever happened during Sandy created an issue which is constantly being recreated every time it rains or every time there's a problem. So I'm thinking that there's some neglected something that was broken or deteriorated during Hurricane Sandy that is causing this problem to reemerge constantly. Because Sandy's been over for a while, and in an apartment like that, if the humidity, and we've gone through a summer already with air conditioners and dehumidification, we've gone through a winter where the relative humidity outside was 10%. If you're building, and we've had heat, which also causes humidity to go down. So the fact that we still have an ongoing mold problem here is telling me that there's something more going on than just some water coming in through the chimney during one storm.
That's a fantastic hypothesis.
You know, so
I like that.
So whether you sign this lease that says you're not responsible, bullpucky. You know, there's something going on.
It's a building problem,
right? And someone, and you need to talk to either, you know, someone, legal aid, or whoever you could talk to if you rent, depending on your economic situation, about getting some legal advice here, because this is an untenable situation. You have mold and you have a respiratory problem. This could be causing some major issues.
Yeah, you
could. And this needs to be more addressed than just you getting rid of the mold, because if you could bleach the whole place. And if there's a moisture issue, it's coming back.
You could call HPD, Housing Preservation and Development.
Yes.
Now, Gene asks on our show page, the front steps of our brownstone have deteriorated because of all of the salt that was placed on them this past winter. What's the best process to repair the cracking, and what's the best paint to use to finish the process?
Well, first of all, you should never paint steps. I'm totally against painting steps because that reduces the frictional resistance of the masonry steps. You want to have steps that are not have a non-slip surface because steps are dangerous.
What do you feel about adding sand to the paint?
Well, if you add what they call painter's sand, this gives it a little granular. But what even with painter's sand, you reduce the frictional resistance because concrete or stone or brickwork has an absorption ratio which really creates a very good surface for walking on. As far as what to use on it, there are a lot of things you could use. You can go into the hardware store and buy ready-mixed powdered concrete that has the granular in it and just mix it with water and fill in the cracks very carefully. There's a material called pore rock that is an expanded kind of concrete that really fills in but does not deteriorate the frictional resistance of the steps.
But I do want to say one other thing. What the person said in the letter, that they're having deterioration after this winter. I don't know if actually the problem is the salt, or it's actually the cold weather where water got underneath the resurfaced finish, because I do a lot of inspections of townhouses and brownstones where they resurface the steps with cement coating, and what happens is water gets in between those layers, freezes, and pops it all out. So what happens is maybe the salt helps the water melt, get in there, but then once it gets cold enough, and remember, we have had an amazingly cold winter and consistently cold, I think your steps may need to be resurfaced, and that's a time-consuming and somewhat expensive job. I would probably say to resurface the steps, you're probably talking $2,000-$3,000.
Stephanie in Fort Greene asks, I need to re-caulk my bathtub. I have absolutely no skills when it comes to this kind of stuff. Should I risk trying to do it myself? Is it a beginner kind of project?
Yes, you could do that yourself. Acrylic kind of caulking is the best kind of material. All you have to do is clean out the joints with some alcohol and maybe some scouring powder.
But I mean, to get out the old caulk, you want to use razor blade or utility knife.
And make it good and clean, and then put the caulking in. And then they sell special sponges that after you put the caulk in, you just wipe it out with these sponges. Always use cold water. Don't use hot water. But you could use hot water to rinse off the sponges. But cold water and very dry mix, and just wipe it out. It comes out beautiful. It's really an easy job. Anybody could do it. And also, you could use your finger to make it nice and smooth.
Mary Ellen from Brooklyn, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. So here is my question. It's similar to the expertise level of the previous caller, which was basically, I'm trying to find out if this is a project my husband and I should take on. We are not handy.
Okay.
So let me preface it with that. It's all the rubber stripping that's around our beautiful glass cube shower. It's about 6 years old, and the stripping that's around the door has completely deteriorated, including that bottom piece.
Yes.
And I've looked at it, and I can see it's not like simple rubber stripping. Those pieces are all multifaceted and angled. Is that something that you can do easily yourself, or is it better to get a professional in to do it? You have to tear it off the glass, and then...
Well, the first question is, can you get the replacement?
I've looked online, and I see things that look really similar to what we have.
If you can get the replacement, getting it off the glass is not the hardest thing in the world. The biggest trick is you get a flat razor blade with a handle, you know, kind of like the stuff you use for scraping off your old inspection sticker or the registration sticker from your windshield.
Okay.
And it's a flat blade with a handle, so you don't and you scrape off the rubber edge of the glass, and then you just replace it. And usually some of this stuff requires a glue. You could use a clear silicone adhesive that goes underneath it. Or if it doesn't require it, you just snap it into place and it holds itself in place. But it shouldn't be horribly difficult. I would see this would be...
Could you caulk it instead?
Well, caulking, it has to be flexible.
No, no, because it's got to open and close. Okay. If she caulks it with herself inside, that's where she's staying the rest of her life.
But, you'll be clean forever.
But even after you use the razor blade, you should wash all of that stuff off with some denatured alcohol to make sure that there is no soap residue or anything like that.
Or if you can't find the denatured, whatever rubbing alcohol you
rubbing
have.
Rubbing alcohol
you have
is
in the
very
closet
good.
Works,
and,
too.
And you could put that on using either the pressure sensitivity method or, as Larry said, you could use the silicone.
Now, we have very little time, but I wanted to sneak David from Brooklyn in. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi. How you doing, Leonard?
What's up,
really
David?
I really enjoy your show and this segment in particular.
Thank you.
Renovated my bathroom, and to my discovery, I didn't realize that the city has some pretty strict regulations on toilets and how big the tanks can be.
Right.
And my question is, I went to Home Depot. I bought one on sale, not the most expensive, towards the least expensive end, and I'm frankly not happy with it. Is there any difference in the way they operate, or is it one better than the other? I'm not talking about aesthetics, just the actual flushing itself. Is there one?
And you're saying that this one doesn't really flush very well?
Well, again, I'm comparing it to a 60-year-old tank that's probably 10 times larger.
You know, I'm kind of at a loss on that one, too, because my toilet's from the 80s, and it flushes just fine, and I'm not changing it out.
They're like a third small. They're tiny.
I know. Yeah. They are tiny. And now they make the ones where you have the one and the two for different types of
Right. I didn't get that one, though.
Well, actually, I find that those actually work pretty well. The two part of it actually works really well. But now with the 1.6 gallons per flush, unless it's configured properly, what I would do is live with the one you have, but go visit people. And when you like the toilet you see, write down the number and then go buy it.
Yeah, but there are ones that are.
And also, one other thing. There are a lot of these different websites like build.com and so on, which sells a lot of different stuff. And a lot of them actually have reviews of the toilets. And that's how I bought my sink.
Because there's really no limit to what you can spend on those things, from $90
right.
to
thousands.
There's no question about it.
Yeah, but I'm saying is if you read the reviews, they'll tell you more of the negative reviews about what people don't like about it.
Yeah, but what they can do is they use the city pressure, which is about 45 to 50 pounds pressure, that pressures up a capsule that actually blows the water into the toilet.
That's on some of them, not all of them.
Not all, but there are the devices like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, we got lots of calls, but we only got those two calls with people trying to answer the quiz. Do you want to carry this over until the next time you're on our show?
No, I think this is a little bit. 2 months is more than most people could stand.
Why not? This way I don't have to do more work.
Oh, I have a word for next time already.
You already have another one?
Yes.
Okay.
So do you want to talk about this
yes,
one? Because
you could try to pronounce this.
Okay. It's Pseudis-O-Domin?
Yes.
Pseudomic.
I don't know which one is plural or synonym.
Singular, you mean.
But it's a pseudis. That's interesting. Pseud meaning fake. I wonder why fake for masonry.
Or pseudosamon.
Yeah, but this is, I found this in Architectural Dictionary, and I thought it was an interesting thing to put on.
Well, you'll have a new one for us when you return to our show on June 11th. That's a couple of months from now. And, of course, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. But can you leave us with some thoughts about taking care of our lives?
Yes. I want all of America to go forth and fix, save energy, money, and
do it safely.
And you think that we're going to be doing that in the next couple
absolutely.
Of months?
Absolutely.
And don't forget those photoelectric smoke detectors.
Oh.